Thank you. Hello, I'm Carl Mäsak. I'm a programmer, and I come from a community where humans and machines coexist peacefully. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I started out as purely a programmer, and I didn't care much about this community stuff. And then I increasingly became aware of the mechanisms and the dynamics that drive communities. So it's been a learning voyage for me as well, and I plan to share a bit of these things with you today. There's this saying that something is as difficult as herding cats, and you can imagine that's probably not easy. The expression is often employed when we're talking about making a group of people, a heterogeneous group of people, do something. And it's especially true, of course, in the open source world, where people are non-paid volunteers. So you don't have the sort of ordinary incentives like money or force to make them do what you want. So that's sort of out of the question from the beginning. What you have instead is something like this. A newcomer comes to the edge of your community and looks in through a lens, want to see what's inside, and maybe finds a document with a typo or finds a wiki page with something omitted and wants to contribute a little bit of something. So you want to take that effort and really treasure it and cherish it and make it count, because that newcomer's first effort, it shows again and again that the people who stay, they usually entered in this way, sort of in a low orbit trajectory, and were just passing through and saying, hey, this color tag in this HTML page is wrong. So you want to take that effort and really make it big and make it count. Another way to see the same phenomenon is to consider people as free-floating particles in a big particle system. And you don't really have to account for them wanting something, because at this stage, when you're a newcomer, you're just testing things out, and you're not sure whether you will become a long-time member or whether you will stay around. So you're basically just bumping into the community and to see what happens. And then you have this initial hump. It could be whatever. It could be, okay, you just need to sign this agreement in order to make your first commit, or you just need to sign up for these web pages in order to submit a bug report. Anything that either technical or bureaucratic difficulties that you can overcome, it is your obligation as a community to reduce. And there's a law of chemistry, which is about particles then, that says that if you decrease this hump, this initial hump, by a fixed unit, your payback for that, the effect that you get from that, increases by a factor. So you get an exponential payback by decreasing this hump. And of course, the lower you get, the more difficult that gets. But the payback gets bigger and bigger, because more people get over this hump. As a community, the Perl6 community has an outlook on community dynamics from the beginning. This is how we started out. This quote, we traced it back to sometime in 2000, that Larry Wall said that this version of Perl should be the community rewrite of Perl. And we'll take the appropriate time to also rewrite the community itself, to think about the community dynamics and what we can do about them. And this was at a point, I might add, when Perl 5 was in sort of a slump. People were discouraged for various reasons, and there was a lot of bickering on mailing lists and fora and so on. And it's not the same situation today, but back in 2000, that's where we were. So here's sort of an image of the community as a ball of something, and a general timeline. We tend to have this 10-year view of things. We started 10 years ago, and we imagine that in 9 or 10 years or so, we will be a big recognized player, and right now we're sort of in the middle and building towards that. And well, we find ourselves in a context, and this context we were surprised to find looks a bit like this. So there's this existing Perl 5 community, which was big already in 2000 and is big still today, and today it's thriving and doing very well, and this image is not to scale. I mean, the Perl 5 community is probably a lot bigger relatively to Perl 6 than this, in terms of modules, in terms of people contributing every day, in terms of people getting their paycheck from Perl 5. And we're back down here, sort of basking in the shadow of Perl 5 and often comparing ourselves to it and thinking, what can we do and what can we improve, and how can we preserve the Perl culture while still getting the good bits from what we already have. And a few of the ideas that I think are original in the Perl 6 culture I'm going to talk about now. This is one of them. An early contributor, Audrey Tang, greeted people who came in with this one idea, this one typo that they wanted to fix, or one bug that they wanted to report, by saying to them, hey, you just got commit access to our repository, welcome aboard. And as your first commit, please add yourself to the big list of authors. So this was a way to reducing the initial barrier right away, saying, okay, you're now a contributor. You have this complaint, please go and fix it. It's not that hard. And this, I imagine, sounds a bit scary. I mean, is it really a good idea to invite 100 or 200 people that you never met into your community project and giving them full write access to everything? And from that, we have this general notion of trusting the anarchy. And I'm still surprised at some days that it actually works. We have virtually no spam, no vandalism of any kind, and so on. Probably because this is not Wikipedia, this is sort of coders from the beginning, and there's full history of everything. It's easy to revert, and there's not much of an... It doesn't help to vandalize, simply. It would get reverted too easily. And there's the notion of preferring forgiveness to permission. So instead of having people ask, can I do this, just let them do it and see what falls out, and we can always roll it back later. There's this optimize for fun. A general notion of since we're not employed, we're not paid, and we're not forced to do it, everyone who is there of their own will, and what drives us is this general idea of making something, and the enjoyment we get from that, from seeing that idea take form. So what we get is various projects, instead of one hierarchical bureaucracy of something, we have people going on with their own projects, and sometimes we have duplicated effort in the sense that some projects work parallel on more or less the same thing, but in perhaps kind of different ways. And what we instead have is that some projects will survive and some won't, and that's okay. What we will have from that is a bunch of successful projects and a bunch of experienced people who can tell the next generation, oh, hey, I actually tried what you're trying to do right now, and that failed because of these things, and here's what you could think about. So mostly we're just a bunch of ants, all cooperating, sort of, to haul food toward the nest, on average. And this is this sentence, I like it, it's part of the Perl 6 specification in the very earliest parts outlining the project plan. So what are the various sort of vessels of information that we treat in the community? Well, it's mostly the usual things. We have the source code, which we keep in Git, but that's up to each community. Git has the advantage, especially with GitHub, of keeping these barriers low. you generally just need a GitHub account to be able to contribute, make a branch or a patch or whatever. We have the upstream specification outlining what it is we want to build. And it's upstream in the sense that our implementations should adhere, of course, to the specification, and they increasingly try to get nearer to that. But it also works the other way. We often have implementers saying, especially the first time you implement something, coming back and saying, this particular piece of the specification is not so good. It could be a lot simpler. And we go back and look at the specification and say, oh yeah, that actually could be simplified or unified or combined in some way to make things nicer. And it's not that we write a bad spec from the beginning. It's just that it looks good on paper, and when we actually try it out, we find improvements. And I think that's a fairly specific thing to Perl 6 community, that we leave the spec as fluid as we do. Many things are fixed. We talk of it in terms of frozenness. So things are either liquid when they haven't been implemented at all, or they're frozen when they've been very well implemented and tested, and things are in an intermediate sludgy state. Then we have tests, which are downstream to the code, and which keep us honest. You all know about tests, I presume, since you're developers. The special thing here is that when someone reports a bug in our bug tracker, we often make a point of not closing that ticket even after we fixed it. We also want to make sure that we have a test in our spec test suite to cover that behavior. Then we have WikiSend tutorials, which is a way to reach outside of the community. They're quite effective in that. One of our most successful projects in reaching out has been the Perl 6 Advent calendar, which also brought back enough feedback actually to affect the spec. People came in saying, why is this the way it is? And that eventually led to very good discussions that floated back into the spec. Our IRC logs are very important to us, not just because we have a full history since 2005, but also because we mark up the IRC logs with various information. We're lucky enough to host them ourselves. One of our community members has written the software for the IRC logs, so we have a really good ability to mark up bits and pieces of the ordinary text that people write with links to various things, pop-ups explaining abbreviations and so on. So it's quite accessible even to newcomers in that way. You can have a link to a revision of something pointing directly to the repository with that revision and so on. And then we have blogs, which is another outside facing way of communicating, and blogs often take us further on to Hacker News or Reddit or whatever, giving us a larger audience. So all of these pieces sort of interact, and I've told you about some of the lines which are not drawn here, where things affect the others. And I think the important thing to realize here is that all these interactions between the different vessels of information are driven by people. So without the community members, these vessels would be information rich, but they would just sit there. So what you want to do again is reduce the barriers. You want to lower the barriers to report a bug. You want to lower the barriers to make a patch, to make a branch, to cut a release. We have a release guide consisting of 8 to 10 points outlining how to make the release. And we often have people doing it the first time, being a release manager, come back and say, the hardest thing with making this release was picking out a good name for it. And I think that's quite a good evidence that we have a simple release process. That about the human part of it. Then we come to the machine part of our IRC channel. We have various bots. our most important bot is the eval bot, which figures in most discussions. We recognize it as a bot, but we use it as sort of something to bounce back on, and it definitely features in our discussions. It could be as simple as a newcomer comes in, we write a short program to demonstrate something, and the output comes back immediately on the channel. So you don't have to go buy a paste service or something. You don't have to leave the IRC window. Thing you want to show is immediately part of the discussion. Or we speak to each other about different features and how they relate to each other. And form discussion about that. Or we submit a bug via this behavior. So a bug report is most often a piece of discussion just copy-pasted and made into an email to the bug tracker. The eval bot has this extra property that besides the output, it also emits the revision of the implementation we're testing, which is vital part of the information in the bug report. So that's sort of automatically taken care of. Then we have the commit bot, which comes alive every time someone makes a commit and just flashes a simple message on the channel, along with the name of the person committing it, and along with a simple plus plus, which is a karma thing you might be aware of. So there's another bot which keeps track of the karma, sort of community bonus points, which you can then exchange for nothing, really. But they're a sort of community goodwill. If you have high karma, you must have done something. There's a tell bot, which leaves messages for people. Someone is not there, I tell the tellbot to convey a message, and when that person comes back, the tellbot immediately recognizes that and leaves the message. The scene bot, which does a similar thing, it keeps track of when people last said something and when. As a general info bot, which does a number of things, gives us facts and links and world time and information about Unicode code points and so on. There's the access bot. This used to be a website back at the time when the Audrey message was from with the commit bit. So back then you had to make several clicks and fill in someone's name. Now you just write, add this person to that project, and the access bot comes back and says, hey, welcome aboard. There's the hug bot. Filling different purposes. You tell it to hug someone and that hugbot hugs someone. Now, a hug on IRC is no substitute at all for the real thing, of course. But it fills a number of purposes sort of as a symbolic gesture. We use it among ourselves when people are showing visible signs of burnout. We use it for newcomers who show sort of aggressive or destructive behavior, and about half of the people coming in showing negative behavior, when they get a hug, they about half of them react positively and sort of change their attitude and become less trolly, and the other half doesn't change or react negatively to that, and we probably couldn't help them anyway. But it's a nice sort of symbol among everything. IRC tends to get a bit harsh, and the hugbot definitely counteracts that. And finally, there's a build bot, which pops up when things went wrong in the background with some build server. So we have all these bots, and one thing that we have learned from keeping around this number of bots on the channel, interacting all the time, is that there's sort of a golden rule, which is not at all apparent from the beginning when you have just one or two bots, but which becomes increasingly important, and that's don't speak unless spoken to. This goes for a bot. As a bot, you shouldn't just respond randomly to things on the channel. That becomes annoying. And we've actually kicked out bots over time that we were satisfied with before because the community grew more restrictive in this sense. We realized that we had this as a demand, and we worked pretty hard as well to not have bots accidentally trigger each other in sort of an infinite loop, because that would be bad. So the general rule is to elevate people and put them forward and give them all the tools they need as soon as possible, and keep bots around, but keep them silent and make them the perfect servants that they could be. Thank you. I see a question there. Yeah, a quick one. Sorry, which rules? Right. Yes, they're not at all restricted to IRC, definitely not. So the question was, couldn't these two rules, lower barriers and bots shouldn't speak when they're spoken to, be applied to other contexts other than IRC? They definitely can. It's just that IRC is the primary medium for the POSIX community. But they're more general than that, that's true. Oh, thank you.